You're listening to Red Eye on Co-op Radio at CFRO 102.7 FM.
On Monday, July 13th, one lane of the Broad Street Bridge linking downtown Vancouver to Kitsilano will close to vehicle traffic. The lane will be for southbound cyclists only. Northbound cyclists will use one sidewalk and pedestrians will use the other. This lane reallocation is to address safety concerns of cyclists who have been sharing the sidewalk with pedestrians. At least 8 cyclists have suffered injuries over the years. John Puka has studied what makes city streets safe for cyclists. He's a professor at Rutgers University, and he joins me by phone this morning from New Jersey. Hello, John.
Hello, and good morning to everyone there in the greater Vancouver metropolitan area.
How important is it to separate cyclists from cars?
It's extremely important. Motor vehicles, and not just cars, trucks and buses as well, but motor vehicles are the cause of about 98% of serious, and I mean fatal, cyclist injuries in most cities in North America. Certainly the overwhelming, it varies from one city to another, but it's extremely important. There's a lot of less serious injuries that are not due to motor vehicle collisions, but I think it's extremely important to separate the cyclist from the motor vehicles. And you just mentioned another issue, that is the separation of the pedestrian from the cyclist, for example, on that particular bridge. I think that's important as well. If you look at the Netherlands, probably has the best traffic safety record of any country in Europe, and certainly much better than anywhere in North America. And their principle basically is to separate these different modes of transportation. Above all, separate the motor vehicles from the cyclists and the pedestrians. But to the extent that it's necessary, where you have high volumes of cycling or of walking, it's really important also to separate the cyclist from the pedestrian.
So everybody gets their own spot.
That's right, because there's very different operating characteristics. I just had a two-hour bike ride just now, and I find on some of the mixed-use paths, it's not a problem at all if they're lightly used, but if there's really heavy use, I find there's people walking dogs, there's people with baby carriages, there's kids running back and forth. If you really have a high volume of, say, pedestrian traffic on a mixed-use path, it makes it very dangerous and probably inconvenient both for pedestrian and for the cyclist. So because there's so much cycling, for example, in the Netherlands, they find it absolutely essential then to separate pedestrians from cyclists. But again, the most important separation, I think, is a separation of the motor vehicles from the cyclists. That is really the biggest danger. Motor vehicles cause the overwhelming percentage of serious injuries and fatalities, both to pedestrians and to cyclists.
What's the relationship between the number of cyclists on the road and cyclist safety?
There's a very important concept called safety in numbers, which says as you get more and more people to cycle, that cycling becomes safer and safer for a number of reasons. For one thing, as more people cycle, the cyclists become more visible. And that turns out that's probably the most important factor in traffic safety of any kind, but especially for cyclist safety. If the cyclist isn't even visible to the motorist, it's a really dangerous situation. So the more cyclists you have, the more visible they are, the more of a presence they have on the roadway, and they're less likely then to be hit by the motorist. Secondly, the more cyclists you have, I think the more respect that they generate on the part of the motorists, that they're not just in the field of vision, but they sort of make a statement that we have a right to ride on these roads as well. And I think that the more cyclists there are on the roads, the more it's seen as a legitimate form of getting around your town, very sustainable, by the way, environmentally friendly and a healthy way to get around. And I think the more cyclists you have, for that reason, also the motorists respect the cyclists more. And third, the more cyclists you have, the more political support and public support there is for the variety of cycling facilities you need, whether it's bike paths or bike lanes or bike parking and so forth. And that the situation on that specific bridge there in Vancouver, and there's a number of issues with the bridges at Vancouver because I was there last May, and I think the more cyclists you have, the more likely that you can devote an entire lane to having cyclists going, for example, in the peak hour in one direction, in the off-peak it ought to be really in the other direction. And that's probably the third reason why, as there are more cyclists, it becomes safer. And this is a really important message because some people are concerned, oh, well, you know, they perceive cycling as being dangerous. And the point is, as you increase cycling levels, as you get more and more people to cycle, it becomes safer and safer. And this has been shown in a number of studies around the world without a single exception. You can compare countries, compare different cities, compare cities over time. And what it finds in every single case is, to the extent that you could increase cycling levels, it makes it safer and safer and safer. And then, as you make cycling safer, you encourage even more cycling. So it's a good cycle, in a way.
Are there places in North America where some of these ideas are being adopted by city governments?
Oh, absolutely. All over the place. Even in the United States. Even New York. I'm doing a special case study for the U.S. Department of Transportation just on New York. New York has tripled the amount of cycling facilities since the year 2000, and they've had more than a doubling in the amount of cycling. And they've also had then a very, very slight reduction in cyclist injuries, but they've had a doubling, tripling in the amount of cycling, so that per trip made, it's been getting safer. But even closer to Vancouver, look at the West Coast. If you look at San Francisco, if you look at Portland, look at Seattle, they've been doing fantastic things in terms of promoting more cycling. Portland, that's also one of our case studies for this research project for the U.S. Department of Transportation. Since the year 1990, they have quadrupled the number of bike trips. They've more than quadrupled the percentage of trips by bike to get to work, and they've actually reduced the number of cyclist injuries and fatalities, which it just says it's sort of that, it's that very principle of safety in numbers in action. And the way Portland has done it, and this to some extent also applies for Seattle, but they've tremendously increased their network of separate cycling facilities. So bike lanes, bike paths, they've tremendously increased bike parking. There's the bike transit integration, so all of the buses, just as with BC, your transit system there, all the buses have bike racks on them. And traffic calming, they have now the bicycling boulevards, and I think Vancouver is also doing great things in this respect. I found out, I think it's a great thing, that on all of the routes now where you have a bicycling route, that now the official speed limit for the cars is 30 kilometers an hour, and that's the European speed on those sorts of facilities. It's absolutely crucial that you slow down cars, because as soon as the car is going faster than 30 kilometers an hour, it imposes the risk that it imposes on the cyclist goes up exponentially.
Now, the Vancouver Police Department created a ruckus last month when they started handing out information tickets to cyclists who were going through stop signs, not wearing helmets, that kind of thing. And they believe that one of the critical issues is that cyclists simply aren't following the rules of the road. Is that a factor in bicycle safety?
Well, it probably is. I confess true confessions. I do go through stop signs. I mean, when there's almost no traffic, when I can clearly see there's no traffic on the cross street, it's a very, very lightly traveled road at any rate here in the, I live in a small town here in central New Jersey, and I confess I go through stop signs. I don't speed through them. I go through them very, very slowly. I look very carefully in both directions, so I don't come to a complete stop. I certainly go much more slowly, look in all directions and so forth, but I don't want to be advocating that people go through stop signs and red lights. I think there are probably certain situations where it's really not dangerous, but I think as a general policy, I certainly cannot advocate cyclists going through stop signs and going through red lights. I think especially the issue of going through red lights is, I mean, generally you have traffic signals where you have much busier intersections, and going through a red light, I think, in that sort of a busy intersection really is dangerous. It imposes a risk on the cyclists and on pedestrians as well. So, I mean, there's certainly something to be said for the enforcement of laws that applies to cyclists as well. I mean, I think also the issue of pedestrians and crosswalks. I mean, I've many times been almost hit by cyclists just going right through the pedestrian crosswalk, and there I am, you know, almost hit by the cyclist. So, and if you look at Dutch cities or German cities or Danish cities, I would say they definitely enforce much more strictly the laws that pertain to cyclists, although I personally think they enforce even more strictly the laws applying to motorists vis-a-vis cyclists. But I do think that one of the reasons that cycling is, there's two number of reasons, but certainly one of the reasons that cycling is so much safer in Northern Europe, say in Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands, is on the one hand, motorists are really punished severely if they hit or even endanger cyclists. On the other hand, cyclists, if they go through red lights, you can pretty much guarantee you're going to get a ticket. Likewise, in terms of pedestrian crosswalk. In terms of stop signs, I mean, it's certainly possible. I haven't actually seen a cyclist get a ticket going through a stop sign, but one of the things that these northern European cities do is in those instances where they feel that the cyclists should not have to adhere to certain restrictions, for example, one-way streets, they actually exempt cyclists. So in many cases, you'll see signs saying the cyclist does not have to stop at this particular stop sign or does not have to stop at this particular red light. So if you have it's called a T intersection, and they have many of these, for example, in Denmark, there's a sign right under the traffic signal saying cyclist is exempted from this traffic signal. Or on about half of the one-way streets in, say, German cities, they'll be one-way for cars and have a specific sign saying cyclists can go in either direction they want to. I think it's important, though, at those sorts of intersections where that's the case, or on those streets, for example, one-way streets where cyclists are allowed to go in both directions, to have that sign so that the motorist knows the cyclist will be coming in either direction. I think that's important, but sort of officially, really, these German, Dutch, and Danish cities officially exempt cyclists for many of these restrictions. And the one-way street exemption is a really important one because it tremendously increases the network of bike routes. It makes it just faster as a cyclist getting from point A to point B. If on a one-way street for cars, you can go in either direction if you're a cyclist.
Now, you mentioned the study that you're doing of North American cities, some North American cities that have put in infrastructure to encourage more people to cycle. What kinds of things are you going to be studying?
Well, we're certainly looking at the obvious ones of bike paths, bike lanes. In New York City, I mean, it's sort of astounded myself, sort of the innovative things they've been doing there. They have a director now. Women, it's so wonderful. There's a woman cyclist who is now the head of New York City DOT, the Department of Transportation, and she has really turned things around. So they have, as I say, quadrupled the network of separate bike paths and bike lanes in New York City. They have more than doubled the amount of cycling since 2000. They've been vastly increasing bike parking. So I think that's the sort of thing you see going on in almost every American city, and the result is you really do have a doubling and tripling of the levels of cycling in many of these cities. But the main technique used is putting in new bike lanes, putting in bike paths, and in many cases separating the bike lane from the motorized traffic, actually having, I'm not sure, have barriers of some sort. In some cases, it's a curb, or in other cases, actually bollards, sort of barriers of some kind to separate. It's an on-street lane, but separated by various barriers from the moving motor vehicle traffic. They've done this on five or six major streets in New York City now, and they found that it really, really is very appealing. It like doubles, triples the amount of cycling on those particular routes. So that's part of what we're looking at. The other really important issue, and I think this is something that Vancouver does a really good job at, and that is traffic calming residential neighborhood streets. And when I say traffic calming, I mean sort of the European style of traffic calming, which is 30 kilometers an hour or less, because it encourages more cycling, also it encourages more walking. And the studies that I've seen, and this is in a number of different cities, is once you impose the traffic calming on the motor vehicles, you get a 60 to 80% reduction in cyclist and pedestrian fatalities, and that the improvement in traffic safety is especially important for children. So that's something to keep in mind. I mean, it's not just separate facilities. I think that having these separate bike lanes and bike paths and having the possible having a separation between cyclists and pedestrians and motor vehicles is important. But another really important policy, and it's probably the greatest percentage of the bike route network at any rate, and that is traffic calming lightly traveled residential streets, so that it makes almost every residential street a really, really great bike route.
Well, I was going to ask you what the benefits are of public investment in cycling. Why should cities put money into this? And I think you've given me a lot of answers to that. Is there anything missing from that picture that you'd like to add?
Yep, there's huge economic benefits. You know, it's so much cheaper to invest in cycling facilities than it is to invest in new roads for cars, that's for sure. And by the way, it's also, I happen to be a big advocate of public transportation, but I think investing in cycling facilities is also a cheaper than investing in public transportation. I think you ought to really invest in both. But I mean, one of the really interesting policies right there in Vancouver is you have the most congested transit vehicles, whether they be buses or your SkyTrain, in the center of the metropolitan area. And so one of the really great policies I think you have there in Vancouver is focusing a lot of the new cycling infrastructure in the center of Vancouver, because that's where it takes the extra load, the overcrowding of those public transit vehicles in Vancouver, it takes them off those vehicles so there's less overcrowding. So I think that's sort of, there's a huge economic benefit, I think, to the cycling. There's also a big health benefit. I wonder if your listeners know how healthy it is to cycle. Probably most of your listeners think, oh, cycling is, many of them probably think it's dangerous. Let me tell you, there was a study done by the British Medical Association, and what they found was, for every hour you spend cycling, you add more than an hour to your expected healthy lifetime. Now, that is your lifetime without a major disability. Let me just repeat that. And this is not some weird group. It's the British Medical Association. For every hour you spend cycling, you add more than an hour to your expected healthy lifetime. And it turns out that whatever traffic dangers there are, I mean, that's obviously a health cost. There's been studies done, again, by the British Medical Association, and they found that the health benefits of cycling exceed the dangers or the costs of cycling by a ratio of more than 10 to 1. So I hope everyone in your listening audience goes out there, gets on their bikes or buys a bike and gets on the bike, because it's really healthy. And talking about economic benefits, wow, I mean, from an individual point of view, there have also been these studies. It turns out that most Canadians and Americans, they work 2 months of the year just to finance their cars. Now, wouldn't you rather get out there and cycle and not have to work those, take 2 months vacation instead of working for your car? I don't want to be a slave. I don't have a car, by the way. I truly do not have a car. And I figure I am not enslaved to my car, and I don't work 2 months a year just to finance my car. Plus, by cycling and walking to make virtually all my trips, I'm going to live longer and healthier, and actually it generates these, I think they're called serotonins in your brain, makes you sort of happier and sort of makes you think more clearly. So, I mean, there's almost no downside to the cycling. But I think one of the key concerns is making it even safer. And one of the key aspects here is cycling ought to be for everyone, not just for young men. And I'm afraid in Canadian and American cities that too much cycling is focused on sort of young men, and we need to get more women out there cycling. We need to get seniors and children out there cycling. We need to make cycling safe and convenient for everyone. And I think that's a really great goal in terms of urban transportation.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me this morning, John.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with John Puka. He's a professor at Rutgers University.